Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Doug Ibendahl, Raymond Lopez, Kristen McQuarrie, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. And again, if you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And again, remember, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video all the time at beyondthebeltway.com, whether it is watching us, tuning in to watch us live or through any time throughout the week. And actually, we keep those shows for months and years. So if you want to get caught up on this program, we're in our 38th year. You got a lot of time to put aside. As usual, we have lots to talk about in the 2 hours, and this is going to be a special appeal to everyone listening to the broadcast, wherever you are from. If you're a regular listener to the show, you will know that there has been, with our phone callers, there generally has been very supportive comments by the president. One of the big political issues or questions that a lot of reporters have right now is, did the actions of the president last week, did it affect the base in any way? Are people upset because Donald Trump is talking, Chuck and Nancy? Are they upset because of his apparent shifting of positions on DACA? These are the things that I think a lot of political reporters want to know. So you're really the experts. So let's use the phones tonight, 1-800-723-8289. If you're pleased with what the president has done, let us know. If you're not happy, I think we'd like to hear from that as well. Doug Ibendahl, we start with you because you are the card-carrying official pro-Trump Republican. You were doing that long before, very early in the primary season. So if there's anyone that's carried the water for Donald Trump, it has been you. What is your answer to my question of the night? Are you pleased with his actions of last week?
I am. I know I sound like a broken record saying that. And by the way, thanks for having me on, Bruce. Obviously, I cannot speak for the 63 million people who voted for this president, the everyone in the 30 out of the 50 states that he won. But no, absolutely not. There is no erosion in this base. Donald Trump supporters realize that this man is we've hired the master of negotiation, the guy who literally wrote the book on Art of the Deal. And what's really brilliant, and what a lot of the Beltway pundits are missing, is the brilliance of what the president has done here. He's actually come up with something. He's made DACA. He was already going to do something. He realizes that we're going to treat the people who were brought in here as kids through no fault of their own. We're going to treat those people a little bit different. He was always going to do that. What he's done now, he's put that back on the table, and he's going to get something even more out of it. So I think we're very, very confident here.
Okay. I want to go to Kristen McQuarrie, editorial board member of the Chicago Tribune for the last 5 years. Nice to have you on the program. What's your answer to the question? I mean, you as a reporter, you have questions when you're talking to your colleagues as how is the base going to react to this? How do you think the base will react? Are they going to be is everything going to be hunky-dory like Doug Ibendahl just said?
I think there were some questions initially about whether or not he was completely abandoning building the wall. I think there has been some clarification, and even Chuck Schumer's spokesman came out and said, no, the discussion was that we will not do that in this deal, but it wasn't that he was abandoning it. So I think that did bring some comfort to Trump supporters. I think they get that Congress dropped the ball, and that on health care and tax reform, they understand that Trump can only do so much. He can't act on legislation that never gets to his desk. And this is the base that is tired of the GOP establishment. So I think they're comfortable with this as long as he doesn't abandon some core principles like the wall.
Mike Miller, you're an economist from DePaul University. You've been a guest on this show a long time. You were not a Donald Trump supporter. You didn't vote for him, but you're basically a Republican. Mm-hmm. What's your take on what happened last week?
I thought it was very interesting in that I think that people who support Trump, and I have several people in my family, brothers and sisters, who supported Trump, and they support Trump. They don't necessarily support Republicans. And therefore, he's not going to lose his base on his actions. If he can get things done that he wants to do, I think that they'll be perfectly happy. There's no doubt, though, that the rift within the party is getting wider and wider, that we have the standard Republicans are becoming more and more divided among themselves and against Mr. Trump.
Raymond Lopez also joins us tonight. He is an alderman in Chicago, the 15th Ward. And again, we're going to talk a lot about what things that are near and dear to Ray's heart. But obviously, DACA is one. But from a political standpoint, you're also the ward committeeman of that 15th Ward, Democrat. Were you pleased with what the president had to say and do last week?
You know, I think it highlighted an opportunity for him to show that he can work with other people in Capitol Hill. But I do wonder if the base is going to be happy, because I think that they want to see the firebrand that they elected, and they want to see him keep fighting and fighting and fighting. And that's evident when we look at the remarks of Steve Bannon this week also, saying that they're going to go toe-to-toe with the GOP establishment, labeling them all swamp monsters if they don't follow the president's lead on all these items. When I saw that he reached out to Senator Schumer and Leader Pelosi the night before it was announced, great, he's reaching across the aisle. I woke up in the morning and the whole tagline changed. No, we didn't mean to say there was a deal. And we see that not only with what's going on in our country, but even with like the Paris Agreement, where they kind of announce it, we're looking for a way to stay here, but when the news hits home, he travels back.
But just as we were talking about Donald Trump and whether his actions affected his base, let me ask you, as a Democratic leader, leading Hispanic leader in the city of Chicago, what about your base? What about the Hispanic base? Because the Hispanic base, since Donald Trump announced for president, has not been overly supportive of him. He did better on Election Day than most people thought. But the perceived rhetoric that's come out of Donald Trump, real and perceived, has not been something that Hispanics are happy about. The fact that he might be doing something right now that could be beneficial to a portion of the Hispanic community, is that one less thing that Donald Trump is not a boogeyman on? Are you looking at a different target today, that you can't target Donald Trump this week the way you did maybe the last, 35, 40 weeks?
No, I think the target has stayed the same. And I think that perception is very much reality in all our communities, whether it's Latino, African-American, or ethnic Caucasian. I think that the notion that, as Bruce said, that he's doing something beneficial for DACA is reading too lightly on the topic. What we have
seen.
Does he not
get any credit for it then? I mean, if he were to move forward on this deal, would the level of concern and venom that has been expressed against the president, would it subside at all?
No, I don't think so, because at the center and at the core of what we see is his engagement with communities of color, Latino communities in particular, is that there seems to be a lot of racist animosity fueling a lot of these policy decisions that he's making, these tweets that he makes. And right or wrong, that's how it comes off, and that's how people will continue to perceive him.
Doug will have comments on that, as you listening to the broadcast may have as well. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. If you're a Trump supporter, are you happy with his changing position on DACA? I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight live from Chicago. Back in Chicago, let's go to calls. Let's go to Rosanna, listening in Springfield on WMAY. Go ahead, Rosanna.
Hi, Bruce. Well, this is where I part ways with Mr. Doug Ivindahl, who I love and adore.
By the way, we should mention that this is, for those who are longtime listeners, our caller is Roseanne Polito, who years ago was a huge a supporter of Donald Trump, also early on, and also probably one of the most outspoken, at least media people, on issues of illegal immigration and DACA. So tell us whether or not you are still a fan or not.
Well, I am a Latina also,
yes.
And I don't believe that, I stand with Ann Coulter. I believe she's right on target. And I am just involved with a lot of different groups. We are stunned. We're holding out to see, because a lot of fake news is out there, but in no way do we want DACA to pass. Listen, this is the way we feel. Our veterans before these illegal aliens, Americans first. This is no way putting Americans first. And I am personal friends with many, many angel moms who have lost children at the hands of illegal aliens. And like Ann Coulter said, has he suddenly forgot all the angel moms that he stood with on stage, that he campaigned with? It's very disturbing to me. I love Donald Trump. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, but we are all standing in expectation of what he promised, Americans first.
All right, let's let Ray Lopez respond to what you have to say. Ray?
You know, I think this notion that somehow that the DACA recipients, the people who were brought here as children, are somehow able to be lumped up with, you know, the quote-unquote illegal aliens that are doing crimes in communities is a false notion. Most people who are DACA recipients are employed, they're in college, they are productive members of society, and for no fault of their own are in this country. And to point the finger and for everything except a piece of paper are basically Americans. And to point our fingers at them and treat them like they're somehow the scourge of humanity is a falsehood that and a narrative that is just unacceptable.
I just want to say respectfully to my friend Roseanne, your point's well taken. Roseanne, this is like Ann Coulter. This is her, immigration is her issue. She was way in front of this issue years ago when a lot of people thought that it was a dead issue before Donald Trump came along. But
as was Rosanna Polito.
Rosanna Polito, that's what I meant.
Yeah, okay.
Who did I say?
You said Ann Coulter.
Ann Coulter and Rosanna Polito. That's way ahead of the curve. Rosanna Polito was probably ahead of Ann Coulter on this.
Yes.
But here's what I would say. The only, respectfully, Rosanna, the only thing I would correct from what you said, there is, keep in mind, there is no DACA right now. It was rescinded. Donald Trump, the president, sent it back to Congress where it belongs constitutionally. And you said for 6 months, we're not, you know, these people are not going to be deported. Congress has 6 months to finally do its job. It would have been nice if Barack Obama had especially when he had a majority in both houses when he first came in, had done something on this. This is yet another mess that Donald Trump has to clean up. Let's keep in mind here, the idea that you're going to move on, the idea that Donald Trump is going to deport 800,000 DACA people is not realistic. It's not going to happen. He has said repeatedly that that's not what he wants to do. We see these people as different. It's not going to happen. So let's talk about the best deal that we can get. Look, if we could get, okay. And just because he makes a deal doesn't mean it's going to be DACA the way it was before.
Okay, Ray Lopez.
I just want to say, you know, granted, Barack Obama could have done something better than his executive order. I'll give you that. But let's not put all the blame on Barack Obama for immigration, because ever since Reagan gave amnesty to everyone, nobody, Republican or Democrat, who sat in the White House has touched the illegal immigration issue, the loopholes that exist to allow businesses to benefit
off
the
world. By the way, that was the biggest. Ronald Reagan said that was the biggest mistake he ever made, by the way.
But that was also the greatest thing for millions of people, including my husband's mother.
But do you acknowledge, Ray, that just as you and the media have always painted a very wonderful picture of the DACA, members of our society. Would you acknowledge, however, that there are good Hispanics and there are not so good Hispanics? That there are those who came here illegally. They live in this country illegally. They're involved in gang traffic or drug traffic. They are not good citizens of any country. And would you acknowledge that they do exist in this country?
I think limiting it to Hispanics,
right,
again, is a false narrative, because the undocumented community is not 100% from Mexico.
Okay.
There are people from all kinds of countries all across this world that have stayed here, passed their visas, stayed here without papers.
So there are good and bad in all groups.
And I will say there are good and bad in all groups.
Right.
Do the good outweigh the bad? Absolutely.
including Americans. I mean, I agree with the distinction that Alderman Lopez is making, that I think it's a conservative principle to protect and encourage immigrants to stay who are working and in school and who have to meet all these qualifications to be part of DACA anyway, that there is a distinction to be made between people who are here illegally committing crimes and deporting them.
Rosanna, would you agree with that?
People who are hardworking citizens, that is what our country was built on.
Rosanna, would you agree that there are, and again, there are good illegal immigrants and not so good illegal immigrants, that some people, well, let's call them the DACA population right now, that the vast majority of those are good, hardworking people. And yet there's another group that's not very hardworking, or they're scanning the systems, or they're filling our prisons. Can you acknowledge there's good and bad?
Bruce, I would ask you this. Where did you get your information from? The government? Would I trust my government to give me the statistics on these people? The answer is no. I know already that many have murdered Americans, and those are the people I see. These are personal friends.
And you're talking about, you're specifically talking about DACA
population now.
Okay.
But there were people, some of the DACA people involved in alien smuggling, assault of offenses, domestic violence, drug offenses, DUI, larceny, thefts, criminal trespassing, and we've also been told that through the Obama time that they pretty much just threw vetting these people out the window.
But if someone has broken the law, as you have just described, whether they are Hispanic, regardless of who they are, they should be prosecuted. So the fact that they're DACA or they're gangbangers or they're Polish or they're Romanian, it doesn't make any difference. If you break the law, you should be punished.
That's
Mike
correct.
Miller's got to come.
I was a police dispatcher.
All right, hang on just a second.
Bruce?
Rosanna, I will let Mike get into the conversation here for a minute.
Two questions. Okay, now it's in the hands of Congress where it belongs. It should have never been done this way. I was pretty much in favor of what Obama did. I hated how he did it. However, there's two aspects to it. Number one, are you expecting that these people will be given citizenship? And if the answer is yes, I find that unacceptable. They must remain non-citizens as long as they're here, because they would then have cut in front of people who did it legally. And the reason I also do that is because of what is called a moral hazard. If you have a policy, you have some kind of behavior you don't want to have people doing, but you create a policy that actually prompts that kind of behavior. If you let these people become citizens by, in a sense, breaking our law, you have essentially invited people to break the law to become citizens. So is that acceptable, that we'll bring them into the country, we'll give them a green card, whatever the expression is, that make them legal, but they cannot be citizens?
Well, I think that the question is, are you – you're going to bring them here and just give them green cards? They're already here.
I mean, they're here. I understand,
but some of them have been here since, like in the case of my husband, came here when he was 6 months old.
I get it.
Well, that's what a lot of people don't understand.
But let me answer your question.
Right. Respond.
So at the same time, they're here. We're recognizing them. They meet all the qualifications. Then I think definitely a pathway to citizenship has to be formulated by Congress.
That's where we separate.
But I don't think that, like you said, leapfrogging in front of the entire line that's already waiting is fair to those people
who
come here.
That's my point.
That doesn't mean that you can't get them in the queue to get them in
the process. It's almost as though you blame the Americans for the fact that your husband was brought here when he was a child. Blame his parents for violating the law in the first place. It's not our fault as Americans that this is done. It's only our fault in the sense that we gave them this unfortunate signal, this thing we call in economics a moral hazard. We signaled them, if you could just get across the damn border, you can stay here and we'll even give you benefits like citizenship.
It also raises
we
the question.
We can't do that anymore.
It also raises the question, if somebody's in their 20s or 30s and they've been here since they were 6 months old, why haven't they already started? Why haven't they done the paperwork? Why haven't they started that process that everyone else did who came here legally and in some cases, 6-7 years to become a citizen and follow the law? what have these people been doing exactly? And see, you seem to even acknowledge that they shouldn't have to, that the people who came here were brought here illegally, smuggled in illegally, that they shouldn't be able to leapfrog ahead of people who have followed the rules. That's where your problem is.
We're going to pause. You're not going to give an answer in 10 seconds to that one. 1-800-723-8029. Rosanna, thanks very much for reporting in.
Thanks
from Springfield.
So
I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us from coast to coast and border to border. Everyone who listens and watches this program knows that for many years we do this program from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. And today is a historic day in the history of the museum. Last night we had our big 35th anniversary celebration. But today, including the Radio Hall of Fame, also is downstairs. And we began the day with the Radio Hall of Fame alive and well, right downstairs from where we do this broadcast each and every Sunday night. But then this afternoon, the transition took place. The Radio Hall of Fame is now closed at the moment. We'll come back again in about a year and a half. But again, it is being dismantled as we speak, because on October 21st, we are bringing to Chicago Saturday Night Live, The Experience. It'll be opening on Saturday, October 21st. If you want tickets, you can go to snltheexhibition.com. snltheexhibition.com. You will be hearing me talk about this for a long, long time. It's going to be here through the end of December of 2018. But again, a major transition at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. And so thanks very much. And again, the guys are downstairs literally. They're taping the boxes and putting things ready for storage literally as we speak tonight, just a few steps from where we're doing this broadcast. Back to our discussion before the break. Ray, you were going to make a point to something that Doug had said, and I'll let you pick up the ball and run with it.
So I think the question was actually Mike's about pathways to citizenship.
Yes.
And then legitimizing coming here without papers, mm-hmm, in the hopes of becoming a citizen, getting that prize, and kind of disincentivizing individuals from actually going through the normal process. I just want to say, first and foremost, DACA, like Doug said, the D stands for deferred, which meant action was supposed to take place at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But for many of these individuals who were born here, raised here as children, and are now adults, they need a starting point. And DACA could have been that starting point, should have been that starting point. It would have been great if it legislatively had been
that's how it should have been
starting
done.
Point.
And I would have supported it.
But somebody had to start something. And President Obama started something, right or wrong, but he gave these individuals a chance to get their feet on solid ground so that they could take whatever steps they needed to start normalizing themselves as members of the society.
But right,
during
this period, they could have applied and begun the process of citizenship, right?
And some have, yes.
Okay.
So not everyone's just sat back,
okay,
just waiting for some sort,
okay,
of clemency.
So some action.
People have actually begun taking citizenship tests. Leaders in Chicago, I know for certain, have been encouraging recipients to start becoming citizens, make your application, start getting your paperwork in order.
They can
go
to the military, and they automatically become citizens after serving in the military, if I remember correctly.
That's already legal under current law.
Absolutely.
Last week on this program, when I suggested that if the president was going to move on DACA, he was in a position to ask and or demand from the Democrats, okay, I'm going to give you the protection from your constituency, the DACA constituency, which primarily is Democratic. I'm going to do that for you, but in return, my constituency, they want a wall. Mm-hmm. If you want protection, I mean perpetual protection for the DACA workers, you're going to provide some funding to me because I'm going to build my wall from my base.
No, of course,
I don't know why the president didn't play that card.
I think he still is. I think there's a lot more to come. The wall is just beginning. The DACA deal could not be made just on the wall. That's a given. We need a lot more than that. We need tax relief. We need infrastructure. And I have a on that.
That's
point,
my. Why is that tied to DACA? It would seem to me that getting a
big deal to actually help everybody. On that point, Bruce, I have a challenge for the alderman. Alderman, you say you're for kids. That's what this DACA thing about. Will you prove that tonight? If you are truly for the kids, will you come out tonight and say that you are in favor of school choice for the city of Chicago, so that poor people in your ward?
Doug, you're going.
It's right in. No, I want him to say that he is actually.
I want to just a minute. Guys, go to your.
Let's
corner.
Find out where
go to your corners. Go to your corners. I don't want to move it in a variety of different directions at this moment in time. I want to go to Kristen, though. As a political bargaining chip, did Donald Trump really make such a great deal by basically going to Chuck and going to Nancy, making the, you know, obviously making the deal on the debt limit?
Well, there was no deal. Oh, I'm sorry.
Or the discussion. By bringing up the subject of DACA, which again plays to a constituency that may never thank him for it, what has he got for his base? If they don't have funding for the wall, aren't they going to be ticked off like Rosanna and a lot of other people who want the wall?
I think his base is not unified on DACA. I think his base understands the difference between deporting hardworking, educated kids who came here through no fault of their own and deporting criminals. So I don't think his base is unified on that point. And as for
the wall?
I think there's actually a distinction there, too. I think they want border security. There's some that actually want a physical wall. There are a lot of complications with that and costs associated with that. He did talk about border security. The original Gang of Eight proposal included fencing. So I don't really think he went too far off of the beaten trail by meeting with them and talking with them. And I'll go back to the point I made initially. I think Trump supporters are smart enough to know that the GOP establishment, it has failed at its first two major tasks. Yes. And this was the alternative.
How about this?
We've been talking. What if some people would say, okay, we'll give them a pathway to citizenship under one condition, and that is that the borders are secure, and you give me E-Verify. Therefore, no one can come in and be illegal and get a job. They have
it's
to be
enough.
Legal.
It's
to
not
get
enough.
It was also part of the Gang of Eight proposal. It was also part of Gang of Eight that John Boehner initially signaled support for, and then he let it fall apart, turned his back on it 36 hours after he said he was going to agree to it, after, 8 months of both sides negotiating? All of this was in that.
That is not enough.
The moral hazard would disappear once they can't get in. And I am in favor of legal immigration. I'm just against illegal because I have so many friends who are legal immigrants, and these people are jumping ahead of them.
Is that a fair request? If you want to protect all the DACA people who are here, let's say 100% of them are great people,
and even make them citizens,
and you want to protect them, and you want to provide permanent residence to them, maybe not citizen, permanent residence. Would you acknowledge that there are as a response to that, that the other population in this country who are Republicans or Donald Trump supporters, they want the borders closed. They want to make sure that in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, we're not talking about 800,000 DACA workers, that we may be talking about 1 million or 3 or 5 million more.
Well,
stop the flow of traffic. Human traffic from wherever it is, not just Mexico. Stop the flow of people wanting to come here illegally. Stop that and look at the 800,000 that for whatever reason made it here. They're good citizen. We protect you. You've got permanent residence, but you know what? We are not going to let anybody else in, period.
Well,
why would your side not support that?
Well, I think for two things. I think we have to make a distinction between border security, which I think people on both sides of the aisle want and recognize is something that we need for all our protection. I don't think anyone questions that securing our borders and knowing who's coming in and coming out, whether it's at the airports, whether it's at ports, whether it's at checkpoint, whatever, that security is important. We may disagree on a wall, which really won't stop people from flying
and staying past their visas. The wall is secondary to me.
But I think that the conversation about having secured borders, which for decades, the United States had the largest unsecured border in the world between Canada and the United States.
Because the two countries are so similar.
Right, but also that's also where a lot of our individuals who are no, also doing things as well come through Canada.
Almost nowhere in the world do you have a country as developed as the United States with a relatively developed welfare state next to a country as undeveloped as Mexico. If you look at Germany and the Czech Republic, and they're so similar. And that's why we don't need anything between Canada, because they're not trying to break in illegally, because they're perfectly happy where they are.
Well, I would disagree with some of that.
Certainly there are people
assertion.
Coming from Europe here who overstay their visas. They have to be controlled just as well. This is not Hispanic. This is border. This is the question.
And that's
of border.
Why I say we
and
understand.
I'm willing to say, what about a deal? Secure the border. That doesn't mean a wall, by the way. That means whatever it takes to secure the border.
But I think that in return,
once we know that the borders, once it's secure, then we'll talk about moving the citizenship.
I personally am in favor of that. That's fine. But I think the distinction has to be drawn between securing borders and closing borders.
I don't want to close borders.
Wait a second. We're listening.
The comment that Bruce said was that we had an election here.
We had an election here where the wall was a primary plank of Donald Trump's campaign.
5 million people
of the winner.
We've
heard
it.
A lot from the losers. And, Mike, you were sentenced to listening to Hillary Clinton's audiobook for your betrayal on the Republican Party. we had an election here, and the people said the winner wants a wall. We're going to have a wall. It's not just about the people, about the illegal immigrants. It's also about drugs, the flow of drugs, which Donald Trump talks about all the time. Huge problem here. And has everyone forgotten, in 2006, President George W. Bush signed a border fence wall. We were supposed to have a double-walled fence on the border, hundreds of miles. $8 billion was approved for that. It passed the Senate overwhelmingly. Most Democrats voted for it, including Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. For these Democrats now to say, a border wall is so ridiculous is completely absurd.
And how many tunnels have gone under the walls and fences we have
already?
Well,
you know what? Because we had a very incompetent president in Barack Obama who did not enforce the border. The wall is not a cure-all, but it is one very important part of border
wall
security.
Is a very important.
Alderman, let's face it. You're for border security. You're for open borders. And if these so-called
open
dreamers and these people, I think
if you
thought that these people were going to vote Republican, you would be driving them to them.
Back in Chicago, let's go to Brian and Roselle listening tonight on the internet. Go ahead, Brian.
Hello, good evening.
Go ahead.
Part of the problem that's always overlooked is the employer. I would be all for DACA, and I would say to that young person, okay, we're going to give you legal status, and your parents are going to tell us who they work for, who pays them, how do they earn their income, how do they earn their living. And then I would find that American businessman, say, $20,000 ahead for violating tax laws, immigration laws, employment laws, because that's the dirty little secret. You know, it takes two to tango, and there are many, many, many. I'm in the construction industry. I see it all the time. American businesses that live off of illegal immigrants. And they get away with it scot-free all the time. And all the focus goes on the illegal immigrant. We need to look at the criminal American employer. That's who we need to focus on.
All right. Stand by. Ray, your thoughts.
You know, I think that's a very good point that we never hear brought up by Republicans, by the president, is that, as Brian said, it takes two to tango.
Yeah.
Going back to your point, what's the incentive of coming here? Yeah, that people are coming here for work and whatever, but they know that there are businesses out there that will hire them, give them fake Social Security numbers.
Yep.
The employer will hand it out. And if that person, that undocumented individual, gets pinched, fine, he's got another one waiting at the door. Mm-hmm. Where is the disincentive by the business community to actually engage in this? Where is the president calling him out?
Wait, Alderman, we're on board. Alderman, the Chamber of Commerce was against Donald Trump, newsflash. The Chicago Tribune was against Donald Trump.
As President Trump said, he's going to build a wall against Wall Street for using these people.
You Democrats still don't get it.
No, you're trying to have it both ways. You can't have your cake.
Donald Trump was elected because both parties have failed. He was elected because Republicans and Democrats have failed. And that's why you're losing your base. That's why you're losing your base, because they see a party that doesn't care about law-abiding citizens.
The point is that you want to point the fingers at people who come here for opportunity, then equally point it at the people.
Well, you're talking about E-Verify. E-Verify is one obvious example that Donald Trump wants.
Wait.
But you have never heard the rhetoric against those businesses who hired these individuals. You continuously point the finger at the people who come for the opportunity, but not the people providing it. That's like being upset at drug addicts, but not the drug dealer.
Well, no, sure.
Doug, let me finish because I think you're wrong on this point, only because you're bringing every argument back to Donald Trump. Every argument we're discussing here is not related to Donald Trump. It really isn't. This caller made a very good point. Mm-hmm. The reason why we've not had significant reform of immigration is because many business owners, many of whom are Republican, maybe even a majority mm-hmm. of them are Republican. They're trying to make as much money for themselves or their stockholders as they want, so they'll do whatever they want to get the cheapest labor here. And they're the ones that hire the lobbyists that call, whether it's John Boehner or Paul Ryan or any other Republican leadership or Democrats, and they say, you know what, we don't want this. It's been a bipartisan effort against Republicans and Democrats. We don't want to deal with the issue of E-Verify. Because to me, if you're not dealing with E-Verify, you're really not serious. Because dealing with E-Verify is far more efficient and effective in resolving the problem than building a fence or a wall.
But it means
that Republicans are going to be many Republicans are going to be shown for exactly what we're dealing with here.
Democrats too,
and I Democrats, mean, this is, and this is, it's both.
If you think there aren't like Democratic powerhouse construction company owners out
who have
been avoiding this, this
but
is
primarily
this is
Republicans.
A lot
you
of people. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
There's lots of money to interest in
it.
I mean, this was Barack Obama's biggest cross to bear when he ran for re-election, that he did nothing for immigration reform when they had an opportunity to do so.
Right.
So a lot of people make money off of dysfunction, and both parties have not advanced any form of immigration reform that is acceptable, and that makes sense. I mean, we shouldn't be talking about this problem for 50 years, but here we are.
Well, maybe that's why. You know, your point's well taken about everything coming, me bringing everything back to Donald Trump, Bruce. But I would respectfully say, though, the next step of that, the answer to that is, well, here we finally have a president who's willing to stand up to the do-nothings, to the Mitch McConnells, to the Paul Ryans, to the lackeys for the Chamber of Commerce, who want the illegal immigration.
Yep.
So of course you can't take it away from Donald Trump. We finally have a leader in there, which is exactly why people who are serious about the issue should be supporting him instead of constantly ankle-biting.
I'm trying to find out, which was the question I asked at the beginning, by going across the aisle and talking with Chuck and Nancy.
Yeah.
He knows that's a way that he's going to at least get what he wants in DACA. And the question is, how many people who are the Trump supporters out there, you know, you're one, you've been very outspoken here today. We heard from another one, Roseanne, at the top of the show. The question that I want to know is, are most of the Trump voters, based on what the president did last week with DACA and talking with Chuck and Nancy, going across the aisle,
being the
bipartisan guy, are they out there cheering you tonight, or are they out there cheering Roseanne? That's what I want to know.
We also know there's something else. We know it can be done. E-Verify can be done, partly because a couple months ago, I bought a Glock 26. I bought a weapon. And I had to have a background check. I have a concealed carry already. We already went through all the paperwork.
Tonight?
I'm not packing tonight. You had a sign out front.
I'll respect your sign. You can't carry anywhere in Chicago.
That's why there's no signs.
Yeah. But the idea is that within literally hours, they can tell whether or not I'm allowed to have that handgun. Now, you can't get it there's a waiting time, which is much longer. But most of the verification happens almost instantly. And certainly if you buy a rifle, it happens almost instantly. There's no reason why this could not be done relatively cheaply. And I want to negotiate. I want these people to stay if they're good people working hard. And I'd even say, I'll give you the prize of citizenship as long as we don't send that moral hazard, as long as we control the borders from here on out. And I just
I've never seen
an ability of Congress to do that.
Last point to you, Brian. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was a black female congressman from Houston. Her name was Barbara Jordan, and she made a speech about immigration, and it's on YouTube. And I suggest all the Democrats look it up and watch it. And she was right on point and honest. Illegal immigration drives down the value of average working Americans. And she says that illegal immigration hurts black America and unskilled American labor. And the Democratic Party is way off base with their overboard attitude.
Brian, we've got to move on. Thanks for your call. We'll be back from Chicago shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, wherever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border. You know that frequently on this program, we have shared some discussion about the horrendous shootings and killings that takes place in Chicago on a daily basis. And we've done many, many shows on it going back to the early days of the Obama administration and obviously the way in which President Trump, during his campaign, raised the visibility of Chicago as a very dangerous place to live in so far. If you live in certain areas of the city of Chicago, it's become the new image of this city. I want to spend some time because one of our guests this evening, Ray Lopez, is a Chicago Alderman. He represents the 15th Ward, which is sort of on the southwest side of Chicago for those listening around the country. But I want to spend some time now talking about the problems of crime in Chicago, the problem of shootings as it relates to gang-related activity, which is part of this problem that we have not only in Chicago but in major markets around the United States. And, Alderman, for those who are not familiar with your recent claim to fame, you were an alderman who was very specific in your denunciation of recent shootings in your ward. You did not, like most politicians, talk about the innocence of everyone that had been shot. You drew a line between those innocents who are occasionally shot and sometimes people who are shot who are not innocents. They are part of a gang culture. Your comments were on the front pages of all the papers. There were threats against your life by gangs. The Chicago Police Department was brought in to give you personal security because of the things you had to say. So I give that as a preamble to those listening around the country so they know who is about to address them. But first of all, on the issue of personal security, how difficult has your life been since you made those comments a couple of months ago?
Well, when the security was first started, it was an adjustment. To be clear, I have no security anymore at this point. So life has somewhat returned back to normal for me. Unfortunately, that normal for people in my neighborhoods and for the people that I represent includes almost daily gang violence using assault rifles, high-powered assault rifles, in every neighborhood, fueled by Facebook, fueled by feuds going on social media. And this is something that we are continuing to fight. And yes, I did say that I think the exact quote was, no innocent lives were lost today. Because that is true. There's a difference between the 12-year-old girl walking to the basketball court who gets caught in gang crossfire simply by trying to play basketball. She's innocent. An individual posting on Facebook his latest purchase of an AR-15 with gang tattoos and gang colors and gang signs posted is not innocent. We know that what we associate ourselves with sometimes has repercussions. And living that lifestyle, engaging in that lifestyle, perpetrating that lifestyle, not just on yourself, but on maybe your younger brother, your children, has consequences. And we will continue to raise the alarm in not just my neighborhood, but throughout the entire city, because we have to be aware that there are differences when we see the violence that we're dealing with.
You also made the point about the memorial services that were called for those who had been killed, and that they themselves became somewhat of a ritual or a promotion for that particular gang.
Well, these memorials are creating instant targets in our communities where you have an individual who, in one instance, I can tell you, actually dealing with the no innocent lives comment, we had an individual who was on Facebook at 4 in the morning doing a Facebook Live taunting in a closed gang group, discussion group. Mm-hmm. I'm here at this corner. Come get me if you want to find me. Well, they found him. He was shot dead on the scene. 12 hours later, 10 of his friends came back, started putting candles up, started putting flags, balloons, and whatnot, dressed in their gang colors to remember their lost comrade. When the opposition came back again, unloaded a high-powered rifle on them, killing two, injuring eight others. So having these kind of memorials are just like, for lack of a better term, shooting fish in a barrel in our communities.
One further comment, and then I want to get everybody else an opportunity to engage in this conversation as well. When there have been shootings in the past, this is historic, this goes back, 30, 40 years. When there's a shooting or a killing, nobody seems to know anything. There are very few prosecutions on this. It happens on occasion, but not it's still rare. The code of silence, we hear about the code of silence that the police department has. What can you tell us about the code of silence that exists in the Hispanic community, which you represent? And is that code different than a code of silence that might exist, let's say, in an African-American community?
Well, I represent both African-American and Latino communities. I whether it's Back of the Yards in Bryant Park, which are predominantly Latino, or West Englewood, which is predominantly African-American, we see time and again this code of silence exists no matter what. Fueled in part for different reasons. In the black community, you may have a code of silence because of a distrust for police or how they're going to handle the situation. In the Latino community, it might be either because people are afraid to come forward because of their immigration status, because they feel that somehow they will have to face repercussions for trying to report the violence that they're seeing, or it is because people are either afraid of the gang members finding out that they spoke, or they want to handle the matter themselves. And one of the main issues that we've been telling my community and telling the entire city is that you cannot leave it up to the politicians, to the police, or to the media to solve this issue. You have to come forward. You have to tell us who has the guns, who's selling drugs, who are the bad landlords renting to these individuals and allowing them to evade us every time we get close. You have to be our eyes and ears on the ground. We will do our best to protect you, but there are more of you than there are of them, and we have to stand strong together.
Kristen McCrary, for those around the country, the Chicago Tribune has made this issue one of your cause celebs. I mean, you have dealt so much with this issue and trying to resolve it in Chicago. Where is that battle now, and to what extent can the local political leaders or the local police departments really deal with this issue? And is it beyond them?
I think it has gotten beyond them. I mean, 10 years ago when you started seeing an exodus of middle-class black families from neighborhoods like Chatham, that should have been a big, big warning sign to people at City Hall. They ignored it. I think the mayor has only recently really started to focus a little bit more on trying to develop these neighborhoods, but we're still doing the same stuff. We're handing out money. We're giving money to community centers. I think a lot of these communities need a complete 180. We need to be talking about things like right-to-work zones for some of these communities on the southeast side and south side of Chicago, where you haven't had a business owner come in 20 years. We shouldn't be raising minimum wage laws. We shouldn't be increasing regulation. We should be encouraging employers to go into these neighborhoods and to hire felons. That would be a starting point to me. If I were mayor of Chicago, I would have been working on these kinds of issues from day one. Instead, I feel that the whole story of Chicago as two separate cities has been perpetuated under this mayor, and I'm just not sure in some of these neighborhoods that are almost ghost towns that you can reverse it now.
I want to come back out here from the other side of the aisle this evening. 1-800-723-8029. From coast to coast and border to border, fighting crime, not just in Chicago, fighting crime perhaps in your city as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. Back in Chicago, thanks very much for joining us. Mike Miller, you had a question or comment?
Yeah, I work at a university, and everything in the university now in terms of the latest movement on the left has to do with whiteness studies, and that many of the problems that exist in the black community or Latino community are because of whiteness, because of racism over the years and white privilege and so forth. And many times then some people will say, but of course it's the behavior, it's the culture that leads to the problem. It's not in anything that a white person has done. Is there anything that I live out in a suburb? I live in Cook County. I live in the suburbs. Is there anything that I could do that would change anything in your neighborhood? And I believe the answer is no. The problem is, I don't want to say this sounds terrible, the problem is yours. The problem is not ours. It's not society's. The problem is the culture that leads to this kind of behavior. It has nothing to do with whiteness or what happened 175 years ago. It has to do with terrible behavior, which leads to terrible outcomes. Now, me saying that, does that sound unacceptable? Or do you find that maybe the problem is that you need to look in, the neighborhood has to look in and figure out what to do? Nothing I can do.
I think that simply, well, I've never heard of whiteness studies, but
I assure you it exists.
But I do know what institutional racism is. And I do know that.
I don't know what that is. That's okay.
But that is something where, as you said, going back 175, I'm assuming we're talking about going back from slavery on, and there have been a very concerted effort to keep communities disenfranchised. And I think I get it,
okay.
But I think that if you exclude that fact, it doesn't help us get to a proper starting point. Do I hold you personally responsible for that? No. But I think that if we were to look at the black community, which has had to deal with Jim Crow, which had to deal with all kinds of things.
I understand that, but could they not just put down the guns and not shoot each other? I mean, there's nothing I can do that will behavior.
I get that, I just wanted to say, first off, that we can't discount part of the framework that institutional racism has played.
I don't know what, again, I don't know what institutional racism
additionally,
is.
Let me answer the second part.
But additionally, you are correct as well, is that we all have choices that we make. And if we are in a perfect family that has raised you with values and has taught you how to be a good human being, yeah, we would expect you not to pick up the gun. But when you're dealing with families that have been broken or families that are being discriminated against or persecuted, they don't have the same starting point that you do. That is where, I guess, the whiteness and white privilege argument comes into question.
If these young people were born
in the past 17 to 25
that
years.
But you're dealing with communities. And I'd gladly take any one of you to West Englewood to show you that the community's starting point for a family there is nowhere near the community starting point
where you're starting from.
Can we get back to the point here? Look, you guys can talk about your feelings all day.
Let me talk about facts here.
Most of the murders that are going on now in Chicago, it's related to the heroin trade. These are gangs that are competing for the heroin trade. The alderman has one of the biggest battlegrounds, the Back of the Yards neighborhood, in his neighborhood, where there's four or five Hispanic gangs there that are at war. They're not even using pistols anymore. They're using assault rifles. They're using M16s and AK-47s. The alderman's response, and our mayor and his fellow alderman, their response to that is to declare that Chicago is a sanctuary city and actually put out the welcome mat for these drug cartels to send their people here. That is reality.
Actually,
so their people are dying in his ward, and his response is to put out the welcome mat for more drug dealers so that they can bring the heroin here, sell it here. Chicago is also a major hub for heroin distribution. Further, we got a president now who wants to build a wall on the border. One reason is to stop the inflow of illegal heroin. The alderman is opposed to that. I've brought up before. I've tried to get an answer on giving people something else to do. Let me just finish. 5 seconds. People in that ward need serious leadership. They need to just stop. Instead of going out and pandering for votes and calling Donald Trump a racist like this alderman has done. They need serious leadership there. Mike asked, when are things going to change there? I would say never until the people in that ward get serious leadership, because they certainly don't have it now.
Well,
Ray, thank you.
Those are fighting words.
Yeah, they are. But, they're coming from a Trump supporter who's only trying to bait me. So why don't you start? Why don't you? Why don't you? Why don't you? Why don't you?
Jobs have you created?
Why don't you start? Why don't you start with the truth? Because if you're going to talk about what I've done and what my neighborhoods are, the truth is a good place to start, not your fabricated lies.
As far as lie about.
Well, first off, when the violence in my neighborhoods happen, it usually is not about heroin; it's about cocaine. Second, when you talk about what my response was, it wasn't to blame the wall. It was actually to blame gang members, yes. To blame mm-hmm. assault rifle availability in my community.
What's
and
your
to
solution?
Hold my, excuse me.
Let him finish.
If you're going to start interrupting me with your lies, I'm going to finish with my facts.
About?
Everything so far. So while you're trying to say all I wanted to do was declare the roll out the mat for Sanctuary City, actually I'm one of the few aldermen who opposed the carve outs to protect violent criminals. Do you know that? I don't think so.
You
do you know that I was the
you
one?
You voted for the Sanctuary City, correct?
Let him finish.
Actually, the Sanctuary City was law before I got there. Thank you.
He's only
you
been
support
there two
it.
And a half
you
years.
You support it.
Again, try the truth. Back to your comment, what can you do? How does this impact you? I'm glad he brought up the heroin incident because the heroin that's going on in this city is on the west side of Chicago, and it's mostly kids from the white kids from the suburb who are coming to our city
who
to
are
buy
making
them.
Terrible decisions.
They
in
are
AR,
making
right.
unfortunate decisions yes. that are killing them. That's but correct. As we see, the unfortunate decision-making process is not just my communities alone. It's all our communities. Now, if you want to sit here and talk about the guns, the gangs, the violence, you're right. I have to deal with the guns. I have to deal with the violence. And I have providing the leadership my neighborhood has never gotten, which is to call it out for what it is,
right.
to attack it head on, and not mince words about it. You want to say your president's done a great job? I call bull, because he hasn't. He's tweeted about my communities. He's tweeted about my city. Has he once ever sent resources to deal with that? No.
Yes,
no. Has he ever done anything other than...
How many jobs for Hispanics have you ever created, or for anyone else for that matter? How many have you ever created? This president has created thousands. He wants to create a lot more.
He has created nothing for black and Latino communities.
Doug.
Nothing for black and Latino communities.
Doug. First of all,
this guy called me a liar. I should be able to respond.
You are a liar. You've called people on liars on this program for about 4 years now. Now, right now, I'm telling you, lower your boom, buddy. Lower your boom. You are out of control in this conversation tonight. You want to go back to what the president said? Let's talk about your presidential candidate, which we talked about a lot on this program. He was the only one that put Chicago front and center to talk about these issues because the incumbent president, Barack Obama, didn't even come back to his hometown to address the issue as it was unfolding for 7 years on his watch. So Donald Trump did put it on. Not only did he put it and talk about it at the convention, he talked about it in the inaugural speech. He said that on day one, there was going to be no crime in Chicago.
Which day
there's
are we
crime
on?
In Chicago. What has he done, practically speaking, other than to tweet, what has he done to provide support, whether it's financial, whatever it is? He said, we may have to bring in the feds. Has he brought in the feds? If so, how many? What are they doing? How effective have they been? What has Donald Trump done on his watch to improve the situation for blacks and Hispanics living in neighborhoods in the city of Chicago, and they're trapped in neighborhoods? He spoke about him in the campaign. I supported him when he spoke about it in the campaign. It was good to hear a Republican actually speak about those issues. What has he done since he's been president?
Can I answer?
Yes.
Okay. For number one, he's trying to get the city of Chicago to follow federal law and work with Immigration Customs Enforcement in getting the criminals out, getting the gang members out. What happens? Chicago sues them. Sues the
Do you
administration.
Think all gang members are
undocumented?
And
wants to spend time in litigation because they care more about votes than they do about the people in those neighborhoods. He's trying to get infrastructure. And he's trying to get school choice. He's trying to do a lot.
What infrastructure has he done? He also talked at length when he was talking primarily about the African American community, but he was talking about impoverished communities when he was running for president, unlike any other Republican. Maybe the closest thing to Jack Kemp in the last
you
40
guys
years.
Are agreeing on a few points here.
He
I mean, he did. At the convention, he said, what do you have to lose to a lot of these communities?
Right.
How's it working out for you? I don't mind that he tweets about Chicago violence. I'm glad. I'm glad it's on the front page of the Chicago Tribune every time it happens because we have become totally numb. This is just our everyday life. Nobody cares. Life is not precious anymore. And so I don't mind when he tweets. He puts pressure on Rahm Emanuel and the city council, and that's exactly where the pressure should be.
I
don't think the
that.
President can no, swoop see, in and save some of these cities and write a check. This is much deeper than that, and I think the pressure belongs on local officials.
See, Kristen,
could he be, going back to your issue of economic development, could he be doing something for incentives, economic incentives in these areas to improve the quality of the community, thus improve, create
some jobs?
Why
doesn't Rahm Emanuel do that?
You know what? He's also got tax reform.
Well, Rahm Emanuel should be doing it as well.
Let me just say this.
Ray.
The tweets, you're right. Kristen, I agree. We've become numb in our city. I'm constantly at every shooting in my ward trying to beat the drum to wake people up, to get them to understand that this is something that impacts us all, whether we know it or not. But I think, to your point, Bruce, can the president do something? Yeah. Focus on the stem of illegal guns coming into our city. The straw purchases. Ban assault weapons. High-powered assault rifles. Get those weapons out of our hands, out of our communities. We don't need them. I know some
they're
people
already gang members. They're already using those.
I know that some people will disagree, but that's my prerogative. I don't think those weapons belong in people's hands. But there are things that the president can do which he has not done. Not even just on economics. He has not done anything to send additional support.
Houston, back in Chicago. Let's go to Brian, listening to us in Addison, Illinois. Go ahead, Brian. You're on Beyond the Beltway.
Hey, Bruce. This is Brian, your friendly neighborhood libertarian, and I'm going to put a big wet on everybody's night. Hi, Doug. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
I want to chime in with something that people have kind of danced around, but it is about the drug, specifically the economics of the drug. I heard the absurd discussion about needing to ban guns. Well, the guns are there because of the drug, and the drugs are already banned. Obviously, that's not working. The idea is, economically, you legalize or at least decriminalize the drugs, the prices plummet, you put the gangs out of business. They are funding that violence. The reason the violence exists is because the money is so lucrative. That's why they're at war there. You decriminalize, legalize those drugs, you wipe out that market. We learned this after the 1920s with Prohibition. You do that, you can end that violence literally overnight. You'll put them out of business, and then you can bring in legitimate businesses. What Kristen brought in earlier about bringing in the businesses, lowering the regulations, allowing right-to-work businesses to move in there, and then it will grow. But it's never going to get to that point until you get rid of the violence, and it revolves around the drugs. It's the economics of the drugs.
Brian, let's let all of our guests respond. Go ahead, Kristen.
Well, I guess I have a question for the alderman, since he's more on the ground with all of this. But from the reporting that our reporters have done at the Tribune, a lot of the drug trade is part of the violence, but it's also social media driven, like you were saying. It's actually just little clicks and fights and people getting mad over a girlfriend. I mean, that is what our reporting has said. In addition, I'm just wondering if that's been your experience as well. And when Zach Fardin, the U.S. attorney who left recently, when he departed, he talked about the need to somehow use the internet to you'd have to deal with people's First Amendment rights, but that if you could intercept them during these Facebook wars, it would end a lot of the violence. I don't know. What do you think?
No, you are absolutely correct. A lot of what we see in our neighborhoods, you know, we make the general assumption that everything is
drug-fueled,
and it's not. We have seen time and again, because of Facebook Live posts, because someone's on a corner in someone else's territory, taunting someone else to come get them. A lot of this gets fueled back and forth. Even right now, you know, we had the quadruple homicide in my ward using a high-powered rifle, and one of the opposing gangs went to social media and posted, now we're 10-1, meaning that they've just actually ratcheted their numbers on how many times they've been able to hit or kill people in the opposing gang.
Was that drug-related that you are aware of?
No, that was all
personal.
Interpersonal social media. So it's easy to assume that everything deals with drugs, but things are evolving in a very different way.
Mike Miller, you have a comment on legalizing drugs?
That even, I must say, it almost makes it worse. A woman named Amy Wax at University of Pennsylvania, she's on the law school faculty, she and somebody else wrote an editorial in the Wall Street Journal about bourgeois of philosophy. And if you would just maybe, you know, finish high school and not have a baby until after you're born and work hard and all these kinds of things. And she was attacked essentially for being white, for saying that all people should behave the way that white people behave, because this is a white way of thinking. The problem is these behaviors, again, I'm stunned. I've heard about this happening on Facebook. I'm stunned that anybody would take another life over somebody on a corner.
And this is not just
and there's nothing again. Minorities. There's nothing I can do
Trust
about
Trust me, white
this.
Folks do this too.
I don't know they don't.
Yes, they do.
Okay,
yes,
let's say they do it. The numbers are considerably smaller, especially as a percent. We know in New York that whites are 33% of the population of New York, and they commit 3% of the gun crimes. It's predominantly behavior in other communities.
I would take objection with that. It's not.
No, that's what the data are.
Doug, I want to get your take on legalization of drugs.
Some libertarians in the past I've respected. Obviously, Milton Friedman were in favor of it. No, I think it's an extraordinarily bad idea.
Okay. Brian, thanks very much for your call. We move on. And I want to take just a second. To what extent is the mayor responsible for the continued gun violence in Chicago, Alderman? Well, as the mayor, should he wear the jacket for increasing violent crime in the city or not?
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that the mayor is the reason that violence in the city is escalating. There are a lot of factors escalating. I think that what the mayor has to wear the jacket on is what his response has been to the violence in our communities. And I know there are many people who felt, like Kristen, that this should have been priority number one when he took office, that this should have been right out the gate. But in fairness, that should be priority number one for every elected official in the city of Chicago. Not one. Mm-hmm. Not just me. Every single person who holds office should make fighting violence and creating opportunity within our neighborhoods priority number one. Now, what I can say is obviously the mayor and I got into a very heated discussion last year about anti-violence and anti-violence funds, and that this year we have the start of a two-year, $45 million program that will specifically target 10 of the most dangerous police districts in our city. $1 million going towards violence interruption between gang members, getting in between them before they start shooting each other, as well as $3.5 to $4 million for wraparound and rapid employment services so that the individuals that associate with those hardened criminals, we can separate them and give them employment opportunities to get them out of the neighborhood and get them on the right track. Does that end it? No, that is the stepping point, and I think for the rest of the city, we have to make that our focus moving forward.
This past week, Gary McCarthy, the former head and superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, who was fired by Rahm Emanuel in the wake of the Laquan McDonald incident a couple of years ago, hinted that he is exploring, or said he's creating an exploratory committee to think about whether or not he's going to run for mayor of Chicago. As you look and the record of Gary McCarthy as the police superintendent, was Gary McCarthy, should he have been fired? Was he a scapegoat? Was it a political hatchet job by the mayor? Or was Gary McCarthy doing a bad job in protecting the citizens of Chicago, Alderman?
When I was elected alderman, I had my first budget meeting in October of 2015, and I had told the then superintendent McCarthy to his face that I felt he should have been fired for his handling and his dealing with the communities in the face of Laquan McDonald and other issues. I don't think it was a hatchet job. I think he's responsible for his department and the actions that took place. He has every right to run, as every American citizen does. Is he running to try to save his reputation as a point of personal pride? I don't know. All I do know is that he will have to answer still for the engagement with minority communities across the city. He will have to answer for why in the past two instances he's been the head of the police department, consent decrees have followed him at both locations. He will have a lot to answer for, and I'm not certain if he has the temperament to move forward. Only him and his committee can make that decision.
Kristen, in your view, is Gary McCarthy a viable candidate for mayor of Chicago and someone that could win?
I don't know. I think he's going to have a lot of problems with the Laquan McDonald issue in minority communities. But what he will point out is that the victims of crime in Chicago have largely been minorities. And who comes to the rescue when they pick up the phone and need help? The police. So he does have a lot of support among law enforcement, among firefighters, among public safety officials, and their families who feel that police have been unfairly tarred in this city. But in terms of viability and being able to raise the money and go toe-to-toe with Rahm Emanuel on economic issues, I'm not sure.
But if there was a race between Rahm Emanuel and Gary McCarthy, there obviously is going to be a minority candidate, African-American or Hispanic candidate.
Sure, there'll probably be five or six candidates.
And does that candidate then become the likely winner of a race that would at least split the white vote in Chicago?
Well, first off, we don't have an all-out winner when you have our elections. You have to get 50% plus one of the vote if you're going to win outright. Otherwise, you have to go in a runoff. If I were the mayor, I'd say more of the merrier, because that would mean that all the dissension is going to be so diluted, his core will still carry him through. I think the mayor still has a very good shot of winning, but we have yet to see if there are any viable challengers at this point, regardless of ethnicity, and I'm not running.
You're not?
No.
I'm not running either.
Rahm Emanuel doesn't deserve a re-election. I think I probably voted for him last time just because the other people on the ballot were, like, ridiculously socialist. But he definitely doesn't know what he's doing. He has no clue what's going on with the crime. All he's doing is pandering to people's worst fears and instincts. I mean, we're talking about here, what do we do in these poor neighborhoods? We've got a president. I'm going to bring back to Donald Trump again. Yes, we've got a president now who is serious about helping the inner city on a couple fronts. One, with investment, infrastructure, jobs, opportunity, and another on education. I suspect that Rahm Emanuel.
I hope he does it.
He wants. let make an obvious point here. It makes his job a lot harder when we got a mayor who a week or two ago declared Chicago a Trump-free zone. Think about that. That a mayor of a major city says that the city of Chicago is a Donald Trump-free zone. In other words, we don't want anything to do with the president of the United States.
He says that because he wants to rally the Hispanic vote, and he does not want a Hispanic challenger.
That says he's not serious.
He's going to out-Hispanic a Hispanic.
That means he's only interested in him and not in the people,
you agree
right?
You with that, Ray? He's trying to out-Hispanic a Hispanic on that issue.
Very well be.
I mean Trump keeps handing him these opportunities, though. But, he's just handing this opportunity for Rahm to then stand up and patronize Latino voters.
If you really believe that Trump could save things, and I'm going to say could save things and change things, and actually believe that he cares about everything that he himself pandered to during his campaign, if you actually believe that, then I would go back to the first question and say, well, then what has he done to put his money where his mouth is to address them? Because if you're worried about Rahm beating him up, or if you're worrying about any other Nancy Pelosi or whoever beating him up on issues.
He's actually trying to. Your city that you're an official of is suing him.
Back in Chicago, and we were talking about what the president said he was going to do once elected. He has sent about 30 federal agents. He said he was going to send the feds to Chicago if the mayor could not basically clean up the city. And about 30 federal agents have been sent to the city. Most of them have been working on with ATF. And Alderman, some of these agents are working in your ward. What are they doing there that you're aware of? And is it too early to tell whether there's an impact?
So these individuals from the ATF are here for about a three-month stint. They are part of the mobile ballistics unit. So the federal government has one singular mobile ballistic unit. It's like a giant RV that can test a bullet on site and connect it with the database that the federal government has for ballistic information to try and identify the chain of usage for that gun, that particular gun.
Is that important? I mean, Mike, does that sound like a really important thing to know? I mean, that.
I don't know. I'm not sure how to react.
I can tell you that it is very important to know where this weapon has come from and what it's been used in, because traditionally, if a bullet casing is found at a crime scene, it is sent down to the labs by CPD, and it may take upwards of a couple weeks to identify the kind of weapon that it was used with, you know, to find information on the weapon. Mm-hmm. The mobile ballistic van can actually do it in within hours. And what we have seen is that they're able to identify from just the casing on the floor whether or not that same weapon has been used in any other shootings, whether it's locally, regionally, or nationally. So you're able to try and see where the succession of use is with that weapon. And it does become very important because then when they're able to catch that weapon, they can associate all the other crimes with it.
Okay. Let's go to Mark listening to us in Carmel, California, one of the most beautiful places in the United States, listening to us on KION. Mark, go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce, and thank you and your august panel for having a very spirited debate tonight about many, many subjects that were very interesting to me. And I heard the alderman refer to numerous times, at least six or eight times, the use of assault weapons in these crimes in Chicago, and I know that to be not factually correct. Most of the gangbangers are using pistols, easily concealable or throwaway pistols that have been stolen from somewhere else. And I was just kind of curious about why his focus is so much upon assault rifles. They don't want to walk down the street with a full-length rifle. They want to walk down the street with a little disposable piece. And I know this because I used to listen to a guy out of Texas that every Monday morning he'd run the Chicago butcher bill over the weekend. And he's since stopped doing that because it wasn't quite politically correct. But, you know,
Mark, let the alderman respond to your question. Go ahead.
Thank you.
I'm not sure, Bruce, how someone from California listening to someone from Texas can tell me what weapons I have on my street. I can tell you that I have seen them. I have seen them posted on the Internet. I have seen them collected at the street level. And individuals are, in fact, running around with full-length weapons when they're doing these crimes. I know what an AK-47 looks like, and they are using them on the street. These are not some handheld pistol that's been rigged so that they could shoot an extended clip. These are 223 rounds for an AK-47 or an AR-15.
Yeah, AK-47 is a 7.62. Right.
But, I mean, those are all the weapons that we have seen routinely used, and even if you wanted, I could pull up right now and show you one of the gang sites where they're posting a weapon this big that they're proud of having just purchased for use in my community.
I'm amazed by that because based upon national data, only 3% of all murders are caused by, in terms of gun murders, are related to rifles. And AR-15s and AK-47s are simply a version of a rifle. Mm-hmm. So you might be talking about, at least nationwide, 1% to 2% of all murders with guns are caused by rifles.
If there were more police officers on your street, would crime go down?
No, we cannot police our way out of this. The fact of the matter is that we can try to use the police and use what leverage we have to try and stem some of the violence. But at the end of the day, all of the violence that we see, whether it's in Latino, African-American, or even white communities, is because the avenues for opportunity are on the decline. Jobs are on the decline. Housing is on the decline. Opportunity across the spectrum is on the decline. And you have to address the lack of opportunity these individuals have if you wish to seriously make a dent in the violence we see.
Do you believe that those people who are in gangs now, who will shoot and kill people at the drop of a hat for no reason because they're standing on the wrong corner, do you think these people literally are just a couple of steps away from a life as a good citizen if they only had a job to go to?
No.
You don't think they're criminally inclined?
No.
And will be criminally inclined even if they're working, you know, 9 to 5 at Walmart?
Let's be 100% clear. In the city of Chicago, we know and our police department have identified almost 1,600 individuals who are violent, repeat, gun-offending gang members. Those are the individuals we have to deal with swiftly and strongly. The individuals that we're talking about with the employment, with the job opportunities or other, are those individuals who gravitate around those 1,600 individuals because they have nothing else better to do. Those are the individuals we have to provide opportunity for.
Could those 1,600 be identified as a criminal terrorist group? And could they, and we had Patrick Cotter, a former U.S. attorney here, who got to John Gotti, and he recommended on this program a couple of years ago that you set up a federal strike force, and you identify those 1,600 people, and you treat them like the mob.
You
use the RICO statute against them.
I have personally asked for our city to declare gangs urban terrorists so that we can access our anti-terrorism funds to address them in a very specific way.
This is odd to me.
We're out of time. It may be odd.
The sanctuary cities are about addressing those people.
Thanks to our guests this evening. I want to thank Fritz Goldman and Sam Greenberg and Dan Dorpin for their assistance in the production of this program. It's a Genevieve production, produced in association with WCGO and WIND. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.